From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our big, bombastic, brassy, and trashy week with the king of B-movies, Roger Corman. He's made hundreds of films, including the classics Little Shop of Horrors, Bucket of Blood, House of Usher, The Trip, and Wild Angels. Peter Fonda will talk about starring in the biker film The Wild Angels, and Dick Miller will talk about working in many Corman films, including Bucket of Blood. Then Victoria Price will talk about her father Vincent Price's starring role in the horror film The Tingler. B-movies coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq's senior Shiite Muslim cleric has apparently reached an agreement to end 3 weeks of fighting in the southern Iraqi city of Najaf. Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani returned to the city today for talks with rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. A spokesman for Sistani says the two reached a deal that calls for Sadr's militiamen to leave a religious shrine at the center of the city. It's not clear whether the latest peace deal will stick, but NPR's Ivan Watson says that for the first time in days, the guns are quiet.
The most encouraging sign right now that perhaps this peace deal, unlike previous peace talks, perhaps this one is going somewhere, actually, is the fact that tonight Najaf is having the quietest night in 3 weeks now. There is no bombing. I have not heard American artillery opening fire at all. There were some brief gun battles, some skirmishes around sunset and throughout the afternoon after the ceasefire had been declared. But right now, all I can hear is barking dogs. Najaf is quiet. I think residents are sleeping more comfortably and more soundly than they have in weeks.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Najaf. A new report from the Federal Census Bureau shows that there's been an increase in the number of Americans living below the poverty line and without health insurance. The report says 1.3 million Americans slipped into poverty last year, while the number without health coverage grew by 1.4 million. The American women's soccer team has closed out the Olympic careers of its veterans with a gold medal. The U.S. women beat Brazil 2-1 in overtime. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Athens.
It was a physical game, hard fought by both teams, with fancy footwork by the Brazilians and spirited defense by American goalkeeper Brianna Scurry. The match was tied at one goal apiece at the end of regulation time and went into a second overtime period before the Americans scored again. The winning goal came from Abby Wambach, one of the team's younger players. For veterans Mia Hamm, Julie Foudy, Brandi Chastain, Joy Fawcett, and Christine Lilly, this was the final game together. Three of the players have said they're retiring from Olympic and World Cup competition. The five thrust women's soccer into national prominence by winning the first Women's World Cup and the first women's soccer gold medal at the Olympics. They and their teammates dominated the sport for a decade. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Athens.
American runners swept the medals in the Olympic 200-meter race today. Sean Crawford won the gold, Bernard Williams the silver, and Justin Gatlin the bronze. And the start of the race was delayed as members of the crowd booed and chanted Ken Terrace, the name of their defending champion, who withdrew from the games after missing a drug test. In stocks, the Dow lost 8 points to close at 10,173 in light trading. The Nasdaq was down 8 to 1852. This is NPR News. The Chilean Supreme Court says former dictator Augusto Pinochet may be prosecuted for specific human rights abuses dating back to the 1970s. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
Over the past few years, the 88-year-old general has fought off a series of attempts to prosecute him for the deaths and torture that occurred under his regime. But so far, he's escaped trial. His defense has rested partly on the legal immunity he enjoys as a former head of state. But now the High Court has set aside that immunity in the case of the disappearance of 19 people in the mid-1970s. Human rights activists say the ruling gives hope to the relatives of the disappeared, but there's no guarantee Pinochet will actually be tried. The Supreme Court has lifted Pinochet's immunity before in another case, but Pinochet's lawyers managed to avoid prosecution by claiming that he was too frail, and they intend to use the same strategy again this time. Martin Costi, NPR News.
An aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin said today that terrorism was the most likely cause of the crash of two airliners on Tuesday. Vladimir Yakovlev told the Itar Tass news agency that investigators have not obtained any clues from the two airplanes' flight data recorders. He said the recorders on both planes stopped abruptly with no warning of trouble. Some experts have said that could be evidence of explosions. The two planes, with a total of 89 people on board, took off from the same airport in Moscow within about 45 minutes of each other. They later disappeared from air traffic control radar within minutes of each other, although one was about 600 miles south of Moscow and the other was around 125 miles south. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment. At visa.com/signature.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're celebrating pop culture that you can't accuse of being subtle. Our series is called Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. But for today's show, we'd better throw in the words fast and cheap because it's about B-movies. We start with the king of the Bs, producer and director Roger Corman. He's churned them out in nearly every genre: science fiction, horror, monster and gangster films, and westerns. He also directed Youth in Revolt movies like The Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda, who we'll hear from in a couple of minutes, as the leader of the Hells Angels. The movie helped establish Fonda's career and helped inspire the film Easy Rider. When I spoke with Corman in 1990, he told me the story behind The Wild Angels.
There was a lot of talk about the Hells Angels at that time, and I remember in, it was either Time or Newsweek magazine, there was an article on them, and at the top of the page was a picture of a Hells Angels funeral. It took place in some woods, and they were carrying the coffin, but the members were riding their bikes. And the visual power of that photograph really impressed me. And I was having lunch with Jim Nicholson and Sam Arkoff, who ran American International, and we were talking about various ideas for a film that we might do together, and it kind of came up between all of us that we all thought the Hells Angels would be a good subject. So we agreed that we would do a film about the Hells Angels. I wanted the Hells Angels not to be the nemesis, the heavies. I wanted them to be the leads in the picture. So I developed with Chuck Griffith my own script, which eventually became The Wild Angels. And for a little while there, I and Chuck were hanging out with the angels, going to their parties and so forth. And the picture became a loose compendium of stories they told us about things that they had done.
So tell me what you were like when you were hanging out at Hell's Angels parties.
I was not quite one of the angels. I made a point of bringing the beer and possibly helping to bring some marijuana and one thing and others. And Chuck and I were reasonably well accepted, but we were never quite with them. I remember at one time I had spent a lot of the evening drinking beer and talking with the old lady that is the girlfriend of the president of the chapter of the Hells Angels, and Chuck came over to me, and he said, "You're spending too much time talking to that girl. The leader of the angels has been watching you. He doesn't like it in any way whatsoever." And I realized for a little while I had forgotten what kind of party I was at and where I was. So I said goodbye to her and went over and talked to some guys about some bikes.
Now, you cast some actual Hells Angels as extras in the movie, right?
Yes, we had members of the Venice and San Bernardino chapters of the Hells Angels.
Did they give you any trouble?
No, they didn't really give me trouble. I was very careful as to how I was going to handle them. I thought about it, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to order them around, and that's not my style as a director anyway. On the other hand, I can't appear to be too weak because they'll start to push me around. So I determined that the thing to do was try to be as objective and unemotional as I could, and simply to say, "All right, fellas, the bikes start here. You're going to ride up to here. You're going to turn around that corner, and you're going to pull up in front of that bar over there, and you pull out, and you run into the bar." And I would try to say it that way so it was clear what I wanted, but that I wasn't trying to force them to do anything. And I think they understood and appreciated that, and by and large, we got along pretty well.
Did you pay them well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't remember the exact amounts of money, but it was interesting. We worked out the payment. They got a certain amount of money per day for each angel, and then they got a little bit less than their personal fee to bring their bikes, and then they got a little bit less than the bikes for bringing their women. So this was their scale of values.
Peter Fonda starred in Wild Angels as like the head of the biker gang. He later starred with Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider. But in Wild Angels, there's something very innocent and vulnerable looking about him in spite of the way that he's cast. Did you realize that at the time?
I knew that, and it was a little bit of a problem because I wanted Peter in the film. He was a good actor. He had the right persona, but he's a very tall, thin person, and he wasn't really as tough or as tough-looking as the angels. For that reason, I had him wear a couple of layers of clothing throughout the film in order to build up a little bulk. So I was aware of that, but I did what I could.
Director and producer Roger Corman. We'll get back to Corman a little later. First, let's hear from the star of his biker film, Wild Angels, Peter Fonda. That film helped inspire Fonda to make Easy Rider, which brought to the screen a new kind of American hero, the hippie drifter. I spoke with Peter Fonda in 1998.
I think it's time to hear a scene from Wild Angels, your first biker film. And now, in this scene, you're at the funeral of a biker played by Bruce Dern, and his coffin is covered by a Nazi flag. There's a minister delivering a eulogy, which you think is really phony, so you interrupt the eulogy to say this.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
I apologize. But tell me, just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. We want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
And as you can hear, they are totally tearing apart the church.
I warned you about that one already.
Peter Fonda, your thoughts listening back to this scene?
Far out.
that's groovy first, would be the other alternative.
No, not groovy, just far out. And, you know, what the heck. You would have to pick that scene now. I didn't write it.
Who did?
I can't remember.
How did those lines sound to you at the time? You want to be free to not be hassled by the man.
I thought I had a better way of saying it, but I was reminded that I was playing the leader of a motorcycle gang and didn't necessarily have a larger vocabulary.
Well, this was you're like the leader of a Hell's Angels gang. A kind of real switch from previous roles that you had in movies like Tammy and the Doctor and Lilith. What did you think of yourself as being the biker?
Well, I mean, I liked the job I did in Lilith. I thought I fit the bill well. And in my later years now, I'm enjoying hearing that from people. But I didn't want to be cast as the sensitive roles all the time, and that's what my agents had in mind for me. They thought they wanted me to become the next Dean Jones for Disney. I had other thoughts afoot here. I was a bit too radical for that. And so I started to strike out in a different way.
Now, what do you think Corman cast you in the biker role?
I think he saw me as this very rebellious person who didn't give a rat's ass and went out there and just did what was most, I guess, obnoxious, or at least what shook the cage. Whatever would shake the cage the most into any kind of really set in legislative morality. I really believe that abstract morality has no place in our political or our everyday lives. And I mean, arbitrary morality and abstract authority certainly doesn't. So he saw me as somebody who was always watching for something to step on that looked like abstract authority or arbitrary morality.
So listen, when you were cast in Wild Angels, were you already riding a motorcycle?
Yeah, I'd been riding around a lot with various other glitterati, McQueen and Brando, myself, Ted Marklin, people that...
Oh, boy, it would have been fun to see you and Brando, who had also played a biker, riding around together.
Oh, yeah, actually, he asked me to come by his house one afternoon. He said, come by my house. I left my motorcycle down at Wally Cox's. Would you take me down there? I said, sure, bud. We called him Bud because that was what he was known as a young man in Omaha. A junior in the Midwestern term is always known as Bud. Instead of Marlin Jr. or Junior, he was called Bud. And I said, yeah, Bud, I'll come by. He said, but bring your Bonneville. I had a Triumph Bonneville. And, you know, I thought maybe a car would suffice, but, oh, sure, you can ride in the back of my motorcycle. As we're riding down Ventura Boulevard, trying to beat the rain, Marlin leaned forward and whispered in my ear, did you hate your father? I thought to myself, that's the strangest question to have come from this dude who's holding on, his arms around me. I'm wondering, why does he have his arms around me? What am I in for with Marlin here?
What'd you say?
I just said no. Right. In the long run, Marlin, no. And I talk about it in that way in the book. Uh-huh. An example that, in fact, I knew that I loved my father. I was confused and wondered whether he loved me.
My guest is Peter Fonda. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Peter Fonda. When we left off, we were talking about the biker film, The Wild Angels.
Now, there is a poster of you from this movie that you say sold, what, 16 million copies in America or something like that?
Easily, yeah.
How seriously did you take yourself at the time as a biker icon?
I didn't even put those two things together. I was brought into Corman's office. He was over at 20th Century Fox. Had a deal making films over there. And he said he wanted to make, and my hair was rather long, and I was considered a weird hippie. And he said he wanted to make a motorcycle movie, a movie about the Hells Angels that wasn't making a statement, which I found to be rather far out, because I think anytime you make a movie about the Hells Angels, you're covering statement all over the place. So I thought, well, let's see if he can do it. I said, I'm in. And eventually I was called, and actually, the first time I was called to play Bruce Dern's part.
The loser.
The loser, yeah. And I said, I can do this one easily. Anyway, it turned out that the fellow who's cast to play the part that I ended up playing didn't know how to ride a motorcycle, so I got the gig. But at the same price, I got to play for being the loser, who's a stiff for about a third of the film.
Right. It's funny. When you were young and going to boarding school and private school, you write that you had the image of being a sissy, and for a while you were even called Fairy Fonda. That was in part because you had to play the role of a fair maiden in the Pirates of Penzance at an all-boys school.
Also, the fact that I weighed probably 82 pounds.
Yeah, you were real, like, skinny marink at the time. Not that you ever put on a lot of weight in later life, but anyways, it's a kind of far cry from that image, you know, from the sissy image that you had to, you know, the biker.
Worked.
Did you like that change? Did you find it amusing, or did you take it really seriously?
Well, that particular part of the change I found very amusing. And even writing the script with Dennis, it was a lot of fun and an amusement to it. I was definitely bent to do something different in my life, and I went for it. Next film, what are you going to do next? Let me find out if I should chain myself to this chair and handcuff myself so I don't come crawling through the mic.
I have a question about Roger Corman's The Trip, but you'll be spared from any clips.
Roll the clips. I can handle it.
Okay. This is an LSD movie with lots of, like, swirling psychedelic colors intercut in the trip scenes. Now, were you already, I imagine you were already tripping a lot yourself when you shot this movie?
No, you couldn't really do that. I think I'd end up looking at the camera and just starting to crack up, thinking these guys are really serious, aren't they?
No, I don't mean while making the movie, but I mean, I don't mean you were high during the shooting of the movie necessarily, but you already knew a lot about acid traps by the time you made the movie, right?
Not a lot, I think, probably. I only took my reputation for consumption far exceeds the actual amount of controlled substances that I ever attempted or tried. But I knew what it was. I knew what it was. I had had an altered state several times before. Roger and I talked about making a movie about that thing, and I tried to get Roger to go for it, too, so he'd know what an altered state was, because I was very specific, and I said, it's not, you know, about flashing lights and swirling things overlaid on images on film. That's what you see in the discotheques, because they don't know how to recreate it. And Jack Nicholson wrote the script, and Jack's script was absolutely brilliant. He did it all with stock footage, some footage that we would shoot in a cutting matter. In other words, he made the rhythm of the cuts and what the visual image was against your eyes into an altered state. It was a brilliant thing. And Roger copped to the flashing lights and swirling things, overlaid images of the rest of us, which rather disappointed me. But the good part about it all was first that I got to work with Dennis Hopper, who was in the film in a supporting role, by telling Roger, who was not going to shoot some of the images that were really necessary to make something out of it. And Dennis and I went off with the camera and film to the desert and shot stuff of me running through sand dunes and things like that. They didn't cut very well, but you sure could see the difference in the footage we shot compared to the footage that Roger shot.
Now, how did you and Dennis Hopper decide to do Easy Rider, your own version of a biker film?
Well, as I said, I had been given this as my daily lesson. What it was, I was in Toronto, Canada, in September of 1967, attending a big convention of theater owners and exhibitors and distributors. And at the second day of lunch with 1,200 people, I was up at a big table of glitterati. Now, I had been through all this, the normal stuff of selling a film, talking to the press, so I had a very nice custom-made double-breasted suit and a really cool shirt and tie and no shoes or socks. So everybody would come in to visit me, to interview me, just couldn't take their eyes off the fact that I had bare feet, and they just stare at the bare feet, which was, of course, the desired effect. And actually, the day before, when I was given my lesson by Jack Valenti, he looked right at me as I was sitting down on the floor with the rest of the plebes and said, we have to stop making movies about motorcycles, sex, and drugs, and start making more movies like Dr. Doolittle, which cost $27 million. And I went back to my room. Okay, no more sex, motorcycles, sex, and drugs movie. But I'd come up with this story the night before I said that line of Easy Rider. Called Dennis on the phone. It was 4:30 Toronto time. On the 27th of September, 1967, and 1:30 in L.A. time, and I called Dennis, told him the story that I'd made up, and he said, that's far out, what are you going to do? I said, well, I thought you'd direct it, I'll produce it, we'd both write it and act in it, we'd save some money, and I believe we'd make a movie that would be commercially successful, and that's how it started.
What did you want your motorcycle to look like for the movie?
Just what it looked like, all that steel and all that engine between my legs and that red, white, and blue and star-spangled gas tank. I thought it was like a huge phallic symbol that I'd be riding across the country.
And that's the effect you wanted.
Well, exactly. And Dennis wanted me in white leathers, and I said, no, this is an Evel Knievel. We stay in black leathers. We don't want to count out the S&M crowd from this movie. We want to get as many people in here as possible. And black leather plays a lot better, believe me, Dennis. And so, you know, at any rate, I put spurs on even. Very few people realize that I was wearing spurs during that movie. I was trying to tell you we were making a Western that happened to have sex and drugs and motorcycles in it.
You say in your book that as soon as you had your motorcycle and your leathers, you started riding the L.A. freeway at night to practice, I guess. But you were stopped every night by the police. What were those encounters like?
Well, I was stopped because I was wearing the flag on the back. I had the costume on, and I had the flag in the back of my jacket. And they thought I was degrading the flag. So they would arrest me, and of course I made sure that I didn't have any money with me. I had my driver's license and Platinum American Express card, but no money. And they would bust me for vagrancy and take me down. Eventually they'd have to let me go and bring me back to my motorcycle, and off I'd go and riding around. After the success of the film in 1969, by 1970, every cop car had a flag on its fender, every cop had a flag on his sleeve, and suddenly it was hip to wear flags wherever you wanted them all the time. It was more of an homage than it was something against the country. I got the idea, by the way, from John Wayne in Flying Tigers, only I decided that a national Chinese flag wouldn't really work too well in Easy Rider.
Now, what did your father, Henry Fonda, think of Easy Rider and your image as, you know, the countercultural movie star who rode a motorcycle and went on, you know, trips of both kinds, the acid and road kind? And in movie terms, it made a fortune. I mean, you know,
you didn't know
good,
that yet.
So, right,
and
right.
I knew we would make some money, and therefore mm-hmm. Dennis and I would have a track record and we could make another motion picture. It was later into it that I realized how far out it would go. And my dad, by this time, by the way, I realized we were going to go to a much broader audience than I figured mm-hmm. originally. My dad said, you know, this is pretty thin here. I don't think people are going to understand what's happening. I mean, we don't know where you're going. I said, well, Dennis says, I'm going down to Mardi Gras. I'm going to give me a Mardi Gras queen in the first campfire. Dad said, well, son, that's a little bit thin. I don't think that'll hang in there. I don't think the audience, I don't think we'll stay with you. And he was entitled to his opinion. But what he hadn't factored in fact, I wish I was smart enough to say that I factored in, was as the Flower Children and hippies came into being, we had our own language, we had our own art, we had our own poetry, music, our whole morality, our customs. What we didn't have was our own movie. And when Easy Rider popped on, that became our own movie, and that transcended everything else and became the icon that it was.
Peter Fonda, recorded in 1998. This summer, he starred in the PBS movie A Thief of Time, based on a Tony Hillerman novel. More on B-movies in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with B-movie king Roger Corman. Also, Dick Miller tells us about playing an Indian and a cowboy in his first Corman film, and Victoria Price tells us about her father Vincent Price's starring role in the horror classic The Tingler.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's B-Movie Day in our series Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. Let's get back to the King of the Bees, Roger Corman. He directed many movies in the 50s and 60s, including Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, The Pit and the Pendulum, and The Wasp Woman. In the 70s, his company New World Pictures turned out genre films and movies that tried to cash in on the success of mainstream blockbusters. Corman's Piranha followed Jaws. After Star Wars, Corman made Battle Beyond the Stars. He's still producing and distributing movies through his company Concord New Horizons. Many now famous people got their start working on Corman's low-budget films, people like Martin Scorsese, John Sayles, Francis Ford Coppola, and Robert De Niro. Jack Nicholson got his start playing a masochistic dental patient in Little Shop of Horrors. Let's start with a scene.
You know, most people don't like to go to the dentist, but I rather enjoy it myself, don't you? I mean, there's a real feeling of growth, of progress when that old drill goes in. I mean, I'd almost rather go to the dentist than anywhere, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Now, no Novocaine. It dulls the senses.
This is gonna hurt you more than it is me.
Oh, goody, goody, here it comes.
A lot of incredible actors and directors got started working with you. I'd like to hear the stories behind how you came across some of them. Why don't we start with Jack Nicholson, who I think a lot of people remember his role in Little Shop of Horrors as the masochistic dental patient.
Right.
How did he come across your attention?
Well, I met Jack in an acting class given by Jeff Corey, and I'd been directing maybe 4, 5, 6 pictures when I felt I really had to learn more about acting and actors. So I enrolled in the acting class and met Jack there. From the beginning, I was impressed with his ability. He was and is a very dedicated actor who delved deeply into a character, does a great deal of research, and then is able to bring a great quality of personal humor and insight to the character, and is willing to take chances to go into areas where other actors might pull back. They might prefer to play it safe.
You are, I think, the undisputed king of the cheap, fast movie. Let's talk about some of the ways you developed to make movies that were fast and cheap. I think one of the things you've done a lot is shoot two movies back to back.
Yes. I first started doing that when we would go on location. The cost of taking a movie crew, even a small movie crew such as I would normally work with, the cost of taking that crew on location is fairly high. So if I would go to a location and do two pictures in the location, I could amortize the cost over two pictures. The same thing when shooting in Hollywood, if you're going to build fairly elaborate sets, I would try to find, whenever I could, a second picture that could take advantage of those sets. I would then rearrange the flats a little bit, repaint them so that they would look a little bit different for the second picture, but essentially I could use the elements twice.
Name two movies that were shot back-to-back like this.
All right. I did actually three pictures once in Puerto Rico when I took a company there. We did Battle of Blood Island, a World War II picture, and then I directed The Last Woman on Earth, which was written by Bob Town and actually starred Bob under the name Edward Wayne as an actor because he hadn't finished the script, and I didn't have the money to take him to Puerto Rico to finish the script and take an actor also. And I said, Bob, you're playing the second lead in the film. And then when we were there and things were going well, I called Chuck Griffith and gave him the idea for a comedy horror science fiction film to be called Creature from the Haunted Sea, and we threw in the third picture as well.
So, okay, now casting Robert Towne, the screenwriter, as one of the stars of the movie, I guess that's another example of saving money.
Yes, but I knew that Bob was and is a good actor. He'd been in the same acting class. I'd been in with Jack Nicholson and a number of others, and I knew he was a talented actor.
You've worked in many different genres over the years, and one of the genres that you describe yourself as having created is the black humor horror film, and included in that category would be Little Shop of Horrors and Bucket of Blood. Why did you decide to combine horror and comedy, and did you wonder if the horror audience would be interested in seeing a movie that mocked itself in some ways?
I got the idea of combining horror with humor at a sneak preview of one of my films when a sequence, which was designed as a horror sequence, worked very well, and the audience screamed, really screamed, very loudly. And immediately thereafter, they laughed, and then they got back into the film. And I thought, what they've done is they've reacted the way I wanted, they've screamed at the right moment, and then they realized that they'd been led into it, and they laughed in an almost appreciative way at what I'd done and what their reaction to it was. And I thought there's really a connection there between horror and humor. And then I read a book called Beyond Laughter by a psychiatrist, I think his name was Dr. Grotjohn, in Beverly Hills, in which he talked about the relationship between horror and humor. And I went to see him, as a matter of fact, paid him $100 for 1 hour to talk with him. And he told me some of his theories. And I decided to do a film that would be a comedy horror film. And that was Bucket of Blood, which I shot in 5 days, starring Dick Miller, written by Chuck Griffith. And the film was rather successful and very funny. It did just what I wanted it to do. It got the screams at the right points, and it got a lot of laughter in between. I was very pleased with it, so I tried another one, which was Little Shop of Horrors, which was more slanted towards the humor and less towards the horror. The horror was there, but it was really almost comic horror. And that picture had a rather strange history. It was very wild, rather original, and I shot it in only 2 days and a night, and I expected that I should either have a great success with something like this, or a complete failure. It was so audacious a thing to do. To my somewhat disappointment, I had a moderate success. But what happened over a period of time, the picture became well known, and it kept playing. Every year, I would get additional rental and royalty checks. It would play at midnight screenings on college campuses, things like that. So over a period of years, it did become a rather big success.
You did around 8 Edgar Allan Poe movies, all of which starred Vincent Price. Did you give him his start?
No.
In horror?
No. Vincent had done one horror film before he worked with me. I think it was the Murders in the Wax Museum or something like that in 3D that was successful. And, of course, before that, he'd been a well-known and established Hollywood and Broadway actor. But I think it was probably in the Poe pictures that he got his greatest acclaim, starting with The Fall of the House of Usher and then going to The Pit and the Pendulum all the way through, finally, to the last two films we did in England, Mask of the Red Death and The Tomb of Ligeia.
Your Poe movies seem, in a way, very deeply felt. And I guess I'm thinking particularly here of the Tomb of Ligeia. I mean, some of the movies you made, you were turning them out, let's face it, right? And some of them, you must have felt really deeply. I don't know what the question is, but I guess I'd like to hear about the difference for you between doing a movie that was deeply felt and one that was intended for another audience in a drive-in, and you didn't much care about the subject matter.
I'd always admired the work of Edgar Allan Poe very much, and I read everything he's ever written. And I was very much desirous of doing The Fall of the House of Usher. And I was very pleased that the film had turned out well. And I did take the work very seriously. I had certain theories at that time, one of which is I thought that, or I believe that there are certain movements or times for change in human civilization. And I think that art and science go together more closely than people think. And I think in the 19th century, the concept of the unconscious mind was coming forward, and I felt just as Freud was moving there in a scientific manner, I think that Edgar Allan Poe was doing the same thing in an artistic way. So I tried to combine some of the theories of Freud with the works of Poe in order to bring them together on film as a synthesis.
Roger Corman recorded in 1990. Coming up, an actor featured in many Corman movies, Dick Miller. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from B-movie director and producer Roger Corman. Now let's listen back to my 1990 interview with Dick Miller, who was in dozens of Corman's low-budget movies, including Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, Sorority Girl, The Terror, The Trip, and War of the Satellites. Several of the directors who grew up watching Corman's movies or got their start working for him later paid homage to Miller by casting him in their films. Martin Scorsese, for example, gave Miller the part of a club owner in New York, New York. Before Dick Miller made films, he lived in New York, where he was writing, producing, and directing for TV and theater. He went to L.A. hoping to write screenplays, but he met Corman, who offered him a role in a film.
He was doing his, a second film, a picture called Apache Woman with Lloyd Bridges. And the guy who introduced me said, Dick's a writer. You need any scripts? He says, I got plenty of writers. I don't need any scripts. I need actors. I said, I'm an actor. He said, okay, I'll stick you in a movie. I played an Indian in my first picture. And about halfway through, he asked me, he said, would you like to play a cowboy? I said, you're doing another movie already? He says, no, in the same movie. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, come back next week, you'll play a cowboy in town. So I wound up playing a cowboy and an Indian in my first movie. And darn near came close to shooting myself in the final shootout scene at the end.
Did anybody in the audience notice that it was the same person who was a cowboy and an Indian?
I don't think so, since it was so early. I mean, there was nothing to recognize. Nobody could say, oh, I've seen him before. A lot of dark makeup and some nose plugs. And the difference was, you could tell, that if you look close, if somebody said, that's the same guy, you'd say, oh, of course it is. But I don't think anybody was looking that close.
Did you have to learn how to ride a horse for the movie?
Oh, yeah, the old Hollywood story. Can you ride? Yes, you know. Can you jump out of an airplane? Sure. without a parachute? Of course. You know, they ask you all kinds of things, and you got to lie and say, of course I can do that. I had ridden a little up to that point, horses in stables in Central Park and places like that, and dude ranches, but nothing like cowboys and Indians. And I just figured, I've seen it done, I can do it. And that's pretty much how I learned. I learned on the first picture.
You played the lead in the 1959 Roger Corman movie, Bucket of Blood, and this has become a real cult classic. It was the leading role. You were a waiter in a beatnik coffee house, and you become an artist by covering first your dead cat in clay and then by killing people and covering the corpses in clay and passing it off as sculpture. And once this artist becomes really acclaimed, you also become quite the hipster. Was it fun to spoof the hipster in the movie?
Well, it was made at the height of the coffee shop era. Everybody was going in for espresso.
You mean the coffee and, house, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the basic idea behind the picture was the hipster coffee house groupies at that time and the people who hung around and the no talents and the talents of that era. And I think later on, Roger Corman made a picture called The Trip about the first, you know, big psychedelic outings that were going on, which was a little more serious, but it was also meant to cover that genre of what was happening at the moment. I love making Bucket of Blood. I think it still stands as my favorite picture.
The movie was shot in, I think, 5 days. Can you give us an idea of how you made a movie that quickly?
Well, 5 days was not as tight as it seemed. They were making TV half-hour shows in 2.5 days, and people who had that down had that type of that was a finger snap.
Right.
People who had that down at that moment could make movies that fast. We were when I started with Roger, we were making westerns, and we would make them in 6 days, and that seemed like a fair amount of time. And later on, we got an extra day, a seventh day or an eighth day, and I thought, this is great, what a luxury. So by the time we got around to making a Bucket of Blood, 5 days was kind of a press, but most of the picture was shot in two sets, so it wasn't that much of a push. It's a matter of learning the technique. I think later on, when he made the famous Little Shop of Horrors, which was supposed to have been made in 2 days, and actually 2 days and a couple of spare nights, that also wasn't too much of a push. The people who were involved in it seemed to think, well, 2 days, okay, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, we'll add another day.
You know, Roger Corman says that Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors were part of a new genre that he felt he was creating, the black comedy horror film. And I was wondering if you felt that all the actors had a good sense of humor, the kind of sense of humor that would get all of what was happening in the movie, you know, and enjoy the jokes.
I think at the time he was making those films, Roger didn't have the greatest sense of humor. I have to be honest about that. He wasn't quite sure that Bucket of Blood was going to be a comedy. He thought it was kind of a very serious thriller at the time. That's the truth. And all the people involved with him at the time had great senses of humor. I mean, they would... It was not uncommon for us on location shots to play what you would call dirty tricks on Roger, because he didn't quite catch on to what we were doing at the time. But I'm not saying that he was ignorant of the fact that it was going to be a comedy. I think about halfway through, he got the idea that this is funny. You know, these people are funny. And when he finished it, he said, we've got to make another one. This is how Little Shop of Horrors came about. He said, this is funny. We must make another picture just like it.
Give me an example of the kind of dirty trick that the actors would play on Corman.
It wasn't really a group thing. It was, I think it was more Jonathan Hayes and myself. We had an expression, show me what you mean. He would say, we were out in Hawaii shooting a picture. He said, run out there to the end of the coral and look around and then come running back. And we'd say, show us what you mean, Roger. And he'd run out there and come back and his feet would be bloody through his sneakers. I mean, it was just the coral would cut him up something awful. Or he would say, leap over this ditch, grab those bushes and pull yourself into the cane field. Well, we were told never touch the cane, the sugar cane. It's got these little burrs on it. And somebody would say, show us what you mean, Roger. He'd jump, he'd grab the bushes, and we'd take out an hour while somebody washed his hands out.
Well, did he expect you to do it after he proved that this was a really dangerous and impossible thing to do?
Yes, and we'd do it. I mean, once it was shown to us, we said, okay, fine, you know. But we usually took more precautions than he had taken.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. How come you stayed with Roger Corman for so long, and how long was it?
Let's see. When I went to work for Roger, I was not that serious about my career. I still didn't know if I wanted to be a writer, although I had stopped writing the minute I worked in as an actor in movies. I just said, this is kind of nice. I found it very easy to work for him. He was doing a lot of work, and I mean as many as 5 or 6 films a year, which is unheard of. The studios, you know, major studios barely turn out that kind of product. So I stayed with Roger 5 or 6 years and wound up doing about 35 films for him in that period. The work was easy. It was constant. I didn't have to look for jobs, which is the most difficult part of being an actor, I think. Mm-hmm. And I found myself every couple of months, I'd get a call from him and say, we're going to do another picture, and we got a nice part for you. And as the roles got better, it became easier and easier to stay in that position.
Did he always write a role for you?
He didn't write a role for me. I will always be grateful to Roger for the fact that he didn't write roles for me. He let me do almost any part that came up. I think the opening picture was kind of the sign of which way we were going. I played a cowboy and an Indian. Well, you're not going to typecast me that way. You know? You're not going to say, this guy does West, he does cowboys only or Indians only. I suddenly found myself playing rocket scientists, demented busboys, leading men, villains, everything. And he never said, you can't do that part. You know, he'd say, can you do this? Can you do that? I said, I can do anything. And I found myself in 35 pictures playing practically 35 different roles. I don't think many actors get that kind of opportunity.
What was your reaction when you saw people who you were working with become famous, like Jack Nicholson, who had one of his first roles in Little Shop of Horrors?
Well, see, now that's supposed to be the questions that hurt and really get in deep, but they don't. Jack and I were personal friends for a lot of years. Almost from the time he started making movies, we became buddies. And the relationship stayed that way until he became a huge star, because there is a difference in lifestyles. It's not like your friend is making a quarter of a million or a half a million or even $1 million a year. That you can cope with. He's living a little better than you. But when a guy's making $10 million and $20 million, and I believe he made about $50 or $60 million on his last picture, it becomes almost impossible to maintain a relationship, a personal relationship, because you're either a part of the entourage or, you know, you cease to be a friend. You cease to be part. You become part of the group. So we drifted away from each other. When we see each other, we're friendly, and I think there's probably a great deal of respect for each other there. But as these guys made it, I try to figure out what is it that they have that I don't have. Why is it that the bright teeth or the straight nose or the whatever it is that makes them a star? What got them the edge? I didn't feel bad. I always figured this could still happen to me. Even now, I figure I could still get lucky. Something could come along and I could get lucky and suddenly become hot. You don't have to be a leading man. You could be a John Goodman. You know, you could be a character actor that gets lucky. Something comes along in your career. But basically, if you understand that it is fate, maybe not even that, it's luck. It's luck and not necessarily talent. You can live with it because that luck could be yours too.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Actor Dick Miller recorded in 1990. Coming up, our B-movie show concludes with the horror film The Tingler. We'll hear from Victoria Price, the daughter of the late Vincent Price. This is Fresh Air. Like the other actors we've heard from on today's B-movie show, Vincent Price worked with B-movie king Roger Corman. Some of the horror films they made together include House of Usher, The Pit and the Pendulum, Tales of Terror, The Raven, The Mask of the Red Death, and The Tomb of Ligeia. In 1999, 6 years after Price's death, I spoke with his daughter, Victoria Price. She had just written a biography of her father. She was born in 1962 at the height of his fame when he was just over 50. We talked about a horror film Price made for another low-budget director, William Castle, who was famous for his special effects and the ploys he used to get people into the theater.
Well, let's talk about The Tingler, which is one of Vincent Price's more famous horror films. And The Tingler is a creature that looks a lot like a plastic lobster. Not the most impressive special effect.
No.
That grows in your spine as you become more afraid. But if a tingler gets loose from a person's body, it can kill another person and lodge in their body. But it shrinks if you scream. And in the climactic scene in The Tingler, a tingler has gotten loose, and one of the characters in the movie The Tingler actually owns a movie theater, and the tingler has gotten loose in the movie theater that's owned by this character. So in the movie, Vincent Price darkens the lights in the movie theater and announces to the patrons of this theater that the tingler is loose, and the screen goes to black. And all the real moviegoers see is a black screen. And here's Vincent Price.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not panic, but scream. Scream for your lives. The tingler is loose in this theater. And if you don't scream, it may kill you. Scream. Scream. Keep screaming. Scream for your lives. It's here. It's over here.
Help. Help. Look out, it's under the seat!
Ladies and gentlemen,
look out, it's under the seat!
The tingler has been paralyzed by your screaming. There is no more danger. We will now resume the showing of the movie.
It's Vincent Price
and
the tingler.
That's fabulous.
And of course, the movie theater seats were rigged in a certain way by William Castle so that people who are watching the movie The Tingler would feel what?
Well, they would feel a buzzing sensation. It was called percepto. So, and not every seat was rigged, only a few random seats in the theater. So there you were sitting watching the movie, not expecting anything to happen, and all of a sudden this buzz or this shock would go through your body and you'd scream, and that would start the audience screaming. It was definitely an audience participation kind of thing.
Have you heard great stories from people who saw The Tingler when it was first released?
I have, and John Waters was the best. He called it one of the defining moments of his childhood, and I can only imagine what that must have been like. One of the regrets I have of growing up as Vincent Price's daughter and so having my fear issues about those movies is I've never been able to enjoy the horror genre as some people do with that kind of gleeful excitement that people get. And I regret that because that sounds like so much fun.
Victoria Price speaking about her father Vincent Price in 1999 after the publication of her book, Vincent Price, A Daughter's Biography. Tomorrow we conclude our series, Big Bombastic, Brassy and Trashy. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Megan Howell. I'm Terry Gross.
Falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell. Stenches in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm not a juvenile delinquent.
No.
On the next Fresh Air, we conclude our series Big Bombastic, Brassy and Trashy with a film director whose work celebrates trashy, John Waters. His films include Pink Flamingos, Cry Baby, and Hairspray. His new movie, A Dirty Shame, opens in September. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.